My name is Jan Svoboda. Today is October 8th, 2020. I'm reading the chapter I wrote back in 2017 for the book A Rumbling of Women, Napa Feminists, 1970 to 1990. I grew up in the 50s and 60s in a small town called Rancho Mirage near Palm Springs, California. My parents were both first-generation Americans. Their parents immigrated from Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia. I'm one of three children with an older sister, Joy, and a younger brother, Randy. My parents valued their Eastern European culture, yet were motivated to provide their three children a, quote, American way of life. We lived in a middle-class family with lots of extended family love all around us. My dad worked as a painter and then later as a real estate broker, and our mom also got her real estate license and partnered with him. So on the surface, my family looked similar to the families of my friends and also similar to the sitcoms of the day like Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver. What made us different was the fact that my grandmother lived with us for many years, but few of my friends really knew the big impact of having our grandmother's influence all around us. She would pick familiar herbs and leaves and teach us their names and uses, like the fuzzy ground cover that was chamomile, which was used to feel calm. She was an amazing gardener, raising enormous squash, tomatoes, onions, as well as fruit trees galore. On the sewing machine, she created peasant folk costumes for my sister and me, and she taught the three of us phrases in Czech to recite and Czechoslovakian polkas to dance. She shared her old country fairy tales and songs, as well as her own stories about her life before immigrating to the United States at the age of 14. Regretfully, as a young girl, I kept quiet with my friends about this amazing woman. I kind of hid her from sight because I wanted to be like everyone else. Having my grandmother around so much was so different from the families around us, especially a grandma who had a strong Hungarian Czechoslovakian accent, looked very old-fashioned, and cooked very unusual foods. Yet in reality, looking back, she was my most important advocate and role model in my life. In the small town of Rancho Mirage, our family had a small 14-unit hotel called the Desert Holiday. It was a great place to grow up. I loved playing catch with my brother Randy, hiking together, looking for coyotes and jackrabbits, and searching the canyons for natural hot springs and oases. We would explore every day. Living on the property of a hotel provided us with a nice good-sized swimming pool, a ping-pong table, a 9-hole putting green, and on the weekends, a countless variety of playmates staying for the weekend with their families from nearby Los Angeles. We even had our own Coke machine. In 1962, when I started high school, it seemed to change everything for me. I pretty much ignored the fact that I was a girl until then. I was just a free and adventurous kid, doing what I loved to do most of the time. Sometimes my mom would insist that I wear dresses and curl my hair tightly, but I had a lot of freedom to be me. Playing catch with my brother was eventually set aside and replaced by the things teenage girls did. At least I could stay physically active in the Girls Athletic Association at school, playing sports like basketball, softball, and volleyball. I loved the camaraderie of my teammates and usually idolized my gym teachers and coaches. But times were changing for me, and my interests began marching matching more of my sisters than my brothers. My sister Joy, 2 years older than me, filled me in on what teenage girls were supposed to do, what to wear, how to act, how to apply makeup, and how to work our parents so that they would allow us to go out on Friday and Saturday nights. She mentioned and mentored me by introducing me to the culture of the times, like the music of Simon and Garfunkel, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Bob Dylan, Elvis, Ricky Nelson, and later the Beatles. There were football games and youth center dances and late nights at Denny's, and I learned the moves of the latest dances from her and her best friend, Karen. They also taught me how to dress to be cool and attract boys. I found romance with my boyfriend, Billy, who wrote beautiful poems and was a very good kisser. I also began forming close bonds with my girlfriends. We would talk endlessly on the phone, write notes in class, spend time planning our next adventures. Back then, I was becoming aware that I much preferred to be with girls than with boys. Our girl adventures were centered on attracting boys, even though my central interest was to be with them. And we cruised Palm Canyon Drive, played tennis, stole our parents' liquor, and went to the movies. During my senior year, I was chosen to be cheerleader, and I had endless fun practicing with my friends, cheering in the crowds at football and basketball games, as well as getting into a little bit of mischief. In the late 60s, I packed my bags and set out for my first big solo adventure, college, at the University of Oregon. I was feeling kind of stifled at home. My world seemed really small, and I wanted to explore who I was in a different place. So I ventured out from Southern California up to Eugene, Oregon, away from my family and any preconceived notion about who I was. It didn't take long for my small world view to be challenged as my life morphed into something much bigger. I started questioning my beliefs and my political leanings. I began to question why things were the way they were, rather than just accepting the status quo. Why were men always the leaders? Why were minorities separate from whites? Why was our country sending our young men to fight a war in Vietnam? When I arrived at the University of Oregon, I started dating a guy named Dave, an African-American student who was on the football team. I never would have dated anyone of a different race at home, but at college, I did what I felt like I wanted to do. Having this relationship with Dave, I learned so much from him, like the difference between living in a middle-class family and neighborhood compared with Dave's experience of living in New York slums. Dating a black man, I witnessed how some of my new college friends turned away from me when they saw me walking hand in hand with him on campus. I began to value and seek out friends who were inclusive, open-minded, and open-hearted. At U of O, I discovered that there were gay and lesbian students out in the college community, and they were open about their sexuality, which was really new for me. I had always been around people like family and friends who looked down on gays and lesbians, and when I began to question my own sexuality, I felt ashamed and felt judgment at home. But now in college, I was given the opportunity to explore who I was and move towards self-expression rather than away from it. My eyes were open to the issues of economic inequality as well as of the opposition to the draft and Vietnam War. One of my high school boyfriends, Bobby, was killed in Vietnam, which deeply affected me and made me very against the war. I found support for my questioning rather than accepting the idea of the U.S. sending its young men and women to the other side of the world to fight and die in a war. Through my sociology courses and conversations with other students, I learned that many poor people were not poor due to being unmotivated or lazy, but rather they were poor due to discrimination, racism, classism, lack of opportunity, and the cycle of poverty. I was waking up. At U of O, I was a member of the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, at the university and participated in activities and civil disobedience as a cadre member, demonstrating against the war and against corporations supporting the war. But in the SDS, I also recognized blatant sexism. Men spoke at all meetings, men led each of the small group cadres, and men made all the decisions. While at University of Oregon, I was on the women's volleyball team, and I learned firsthand the difference between how the university treated women athletes and men athletes, and why the protections of Title IX were so needed. Women athletes trained as hard and as often as the men, yet had an inferior gym to play in, almost zero money for travel, and absolutely no recognition even when our U of O team won the Nationals in 1971. This contrasted drastically with what Dave experienced playing on the Duck football team. He had free restaurant dinners, was given a new car to drive, and traveled to games in style. Note, 30 years after winning the Nationals, our women's volleyball team was finally recognized, and all team members were inducted into the U of O Hall of Fame, including me. After earning my BA in 1971 from U of O, I briefly returned home to the desert, but soon found my way to the town of Napa, California, by way of my heart. I followed my heart and entered a committed relationship with a woman for the very first time. She was someone I had known in Palm Springs who had moved up north. I was 22 years old, awakening to who I was, and I was in love. I was both frightened about how this would change my life and excited about the deep feelings I was experiencing. Now, for the first time, I needed to support myself, and I wanted to find good and hopefully meaningful employment. Fortunately, I noticed an ad for a community worker position at the local NCCEO funded for the purpose of reducing poverty, Napa County Council for Economic Opportunity. The agency's director, Esperanza Lugo, interviewed me for the job, and what I remember most from the interview, which was 45 years ago, was how strong Esperanza, or Hope, as who we called her, how Hope spoke and the commitment she showed to serve her community. Everything I heard her say and do expressed her deep love for the migrants and poor families of the Napa Valley. She had been a migrant worker herself and transformed from working in the fields to sitting on the Head Start Board of Directors, to becoming Executive Director of NCCEO. She oversaw the nonprofit that served the entire Napa County. Watching her and working for her greatly impacted me. Hope spoke strongly and gracefully, with determination and passion. And as she advanced, as she advocated for more low-income housing, farm workers' rights, and job training for youth. In this job, as a community worker, and then later as a Head Start teacher in the 70s, I was proud to work for Hope. She was an inspiration to me. Through my community work, I served women with children who needed a place to live and food to eat, women who needed protection from violent husbands, families that needed health care, and mothers who wanted to further their education but couldn't afford child care. I counseled disabled citizens at the rundown downtown residential hotel, found resource support for single mothers, connected families to migrant services, and helped organize demonstrations and picket lines to support the United Farm Workers Union. My life was expanding, and I was meeting many new people, both in the community I served, as well as other like-minded people who were becoming change makers. This was both a pivotal and active time in my life. On a personal level, I was searching for my own identity, like other women in my generation. There were so many issues that needed to be dealt with, and at the same time, there was a rumbling for change inside. All my ideas from my childhood about who I was and who I could be were being dismantled. The expectation from my family and myself had been to graduate from college, get married, and have a family. Yet look at me. I was busy with life, and I was living life on my terms. Finding feminists was a natural outcome of being involved in the community. We met each other at the political gatherings, the picket lines, the city council meetings, the supervisor meetings, the school board meetings, as well as potlucks galore. We met each other at political candidates' support meetings and at Napa College as we advocated for a women's studies program in a bilingual, bicultural childcare facility. As the momentum of a wide network of active women seeking community change grew, so did the desire to have a place of our own. I remember an organizing meeting at Lois Ingalls' house. We had a gathering of about 20 of us to brainstorm our purpose and our goals. Butcher paper was taped up on the wall so that notes could be recorded for all of us to see. Our desire for a place became a reality as we gathered the money together to rent a storefront on 3rd Street, a block down from Jefferson. This became the Napa Valley Women's Center. I'm not sure exactly what year that was, maybe 1972. The editor says 1971. The Women's Center became the place for all of us to meet and kind of centered us. We staffed it daily with volunteers who kept a running record of who called and who came by with donation or asked for something, some kind of assistance, and we kept a calendar of important meetings. We ourselves met on a weekly basis and talked about the important issues we wanted to deal with. I'm not sure exactly what year that this was, Our feminist movement in Napa was devoted to dealing with critical issues of gender inequality, yet that wasn't all. There was also fun and the building of deep friendships. We often gathered together for potlucks to socialize. We gathered to share our writings, to share music, and to dance. Paula Amanjuda and her sister had a rock and roll band that often played at parties and gatherings and at a local restaurant. When they played, many of us showed up, and we danced and danced and would dance some more. A group of us who identified as lesbians regularly drove south to the gay bar scene in San Francisco on weekend evenings to expand our small group of friends and to dance and party until wee hours of the night, something, of course, we couldn't be seen doing in Napa. Women's music began to emerge around the time in the 70s, which was music by women, for women, and about women. The first big tour featured Chris Williamson, Meg Christian, Margie Adam. They performed nearby, not in Napa, but in Sonoma County. Later, we invited Holly Neer, a feminist and peace activist, to perform in Napa. Olivia Records, the first women's music record label, was created in 1973 and published these women's music. Olivia still exists now, even in 2020, and now is a successful travel company for tourists for women. I think of those times and it brings me back to such empowering feelings, personal growth, as well as deep convictions and connections with an amazing group of women. We believe that together we could do amazing things in our community to make it stronger, more compassionate, and open to diversity. I do remember, though, that despite our unity together, we also faced conflict. During the planning of a conference for women at Napa College, a number of us voiced our desire to include a lesbian-themed workshop. There was much discussion between us, as well as with the Napa College administrators, that ended with a decision to not include the workshop at the conference. Looking back, I think that the majority of our women's group did not want the feminist event to be thought of by the larger community as a, quote, lesbian event. There was disappointment, and many of us felt marginalized by our group at the same time. It was surprising to me, and I didn't expect that kind of conflict within our group of women. Meanwhile, my personal life on the downside, I had several relationship breakups. But on the upside, I discovered a passion for teaching young children. For 2 years, I taught preschoolers with Head Start program. Soon, I found myself enrolling into the teaching credential program at nearby Sonoma State University and quickly earned my teaching credential in 1977. That fall, I was hired by Napa Valley Unified School District to teach in the classroom at Carneros Elementary School. I was so excited and motivated to have my own classroom with a room full of young students that I spent One weekend at a women's bookstore in Valencia Street in San Francisco, I found a darling book entitled X, A Fabulous Child's Story by author Lois Gould, published in 1978 by Daughters Publishing. It's a story about a baby who was named X, that nobody could tell whether it was a boy or a girl. This way, X could explore who X was without any gender influences from the outside. Needless to say, X flourished. I brought the book into my classroom the following Monday and read it to my students during circle time that day, and they loved it. It became a favorite book for them to read in our classroom library, and I was often requested to read it to them again at circle time. That was back in 1978, during the political time in California, when Proposition 6 was put on the statewide ballot. It was called the Briggs Initiative, and if it passed, it would have banned gays and lesbians from working in the public school system. The climate locally in Napa at that time was one of distrust and discrimination, and I was careful to have a cover, quote, cover, for my personal life. One of my third grade boys asked if he could take the X book home over the weekend, and of course I said yes. One day, the following week in the middle of class, unannounced, a district administrator appeared at my classroom door. Surprisingly, he he was holding my book. The boy's parents were not happy with the book when he brought it to home, and they shared it with their church minister and governing board, who determined the book should be banned from the classroom because a non-stereotypical child was the main character, and that meant advocating a homosexual lifestyle. The church officials put pressure on the school board, and thus the administrator came into my classroom. He shared with me the church's determination and requested to borrow the book so the school board could review it at their next meeting. In the end, it was suggested that I put the book away for the rest of the school year, but that it wasn't banned forever. I felt the pressure to do so, and it didn't appear back in my classroom, library, or circle time until the following year, and after that, I never heard from anybody about it again. With the possibility of Prop 6 passing, I became very paranoid and very closeted. For the next 20 years as an elementary school teacher, I didn't talk about my personal life at all, except for with two colleagues, my friends Marlene Zimmerman and Sudie Pollock. Since I taught elementary school, I had to be especially careful. The Briggs Initiative didn't pass, but the political climate did not change overnight. There were still many people with anti-gay attitudes. I felt I was blossoming in many ways professionally, but in my personal side, I hid for most of my career. It took a toll on me. I might be sitting in meetings or at lunchtime in the staff room when everyone was talking about their weekend, and I purposely changed pronouns. When I talked about my living situation, I even made up a man's name, and teachers thought I was with a man named Richard. That's just not healthy. But in the 70s and 80s, I really didn't feel that unless I quit teaching, I could really be out front with my sexuality. I was fortunate at that time to find refuge and support as a member of a women's support group led by Judy Feiner, who was a clinical social worker. The group helped me accept and love myself and helped me release much of the shame and self-judgment that had built up over the years. My mission was bringing women and diversity into the classroom, and it was my main driving force as an educator. I learned that if we believe the culture should change, we need to be the part of that change, and I was being called to do something within the classroom. From then on, I was very active in selecting the textbooks that the school district would adopt. There were committees that explore the textbook possibilities before they were actually purchased, and I was involved and included clear and factual information about the civil rights movement, slavery, women's rights, who the founding mothers were, and who the women scientists and mathematicians were. I later served on a statewide textbook review committee in Sacramento, reviewing social studies history textbooks. It was important work. At a certain point, I went my separate way and I stopped going to the Women's Center. The Feminist Connection was formed and nurtured local authors like Ruth Bates and Nancy Manahan, who both published books. Napa College Women's Studies and Reentry Program were flourishing at that time. I left Napa to purchase a house with my partner Conde in the nearby town of Sonoma. My main focus now was my home life, fixing up our house, traveling with our two dogs, and my teaching. I stay connected with Napa through my close friendships and continuing to work in the Napa School District. After 20 years in the classroom, I accepted a position in the district office as a teacher coach. I so missed teaching students, yet the switch to working with adults gave me the freedom to finally be myself more fully. No more hiding. This was a truly big blessing. The women's movement not only motivated me to bring a feminist perspective to what I was doing in my career, it shaped who I became as a person. I had been very introverted, and I became more willing to bring forth my ideas and assume more leadership in my school. My connection with feminism was empowering, especially when I had to face discrimination or judgment with my family and community. I would not have become who I am today, both personally and professionally, without the women's movement and connections with women who were strong and inspirational. I have lifelong friendships from those times that include Lynn Thibault and her daughter Jennifer, Gina Kulik, Ann Schwartz, and Sudie Pollock. Having the national movement with its politics, its fight for equal rights, music, writings, and women speaking out made me feel connected to something real and legitimate. I wish I remembered more of the details of those pivotal years of the 70s and 80s, but what I do remember is the power, the passion, excitement, and camaraderie, and the spirit of our Napa women's movement. Presently, I am in a successful and loving long-term relationship with my partner, Denise Kennedy. We have been together for 20 years and share a beautiful home together in Sonoma with our dog Pepper and cat Jax. We love gardening, camping, hiking, kayaking, spending time with family, and with our two grandchildren, Tetris Ray and Coda. I am retired after a 34-year career, now a spiritual counselor at Center for Spiritual Living, and work part-time as a teacher coach for an educational publishing company. The year I am writing this is 2017. We find our country's president trying to steer our country backwards as he tries to muffle the free press, privatize public schools, turn his back on LGBTQ citizens, isolate us from our international democratic friends, and partner with dictators who don't believe in democracy. It is a troubling time, yet I am inspired to see the next generation of activists rise up and work for the good of our country.